Thanks very much for having me. This, I suppose, tells the story of the process by which I wrote my book, which has just been approved by MUP. So today's a good day, really. But it tells that story. It tells the story as well, I suppose, about the way that memory is deeply contested and the way that my research kind of intersected with public memory. And I suppose it also tells a story of defiance and of men and women trying to fight against an institution which seemed to deny that they even existed. It won't last an hour, I shall tell you now, but at least it leaves a bit of time for questions at the end and ample time for turnaround. So anyway, this is Fighting a Different War. So in the mid-1990s, the queer soldier finally became visible. On the streets, gay rights campaigners led by Peter Tatchell questioned the efficacy of the Ministry of Defence's exclusion of queer personnel from the armed forces, and also the institution's apparent unwillingness to acknowledge that queer men and women had fought in two world wars for a country that criminalised their sexual expression. Within Parliament, MPs who supported lifting the ban used the Second World War and the success of its gay and lesbian personnel as evidence of the MOD's backward approach to the issue. Now, I'll share this story with you today and explore why the suggestion that queer men and women served in the armed forces between 1939 and 1945 continues to pose such a threat to the sanctity of the Second World War and to the sanctity of the armed forces. The story as well should also give you an insight into why researching the history of sexuality should come with a health warning, particularly as it relates to sort of contemporary history. So a bit of background for you to start, to start with. So in 1967, as you may know, 22 years after the end of the Second World War, the Sexual Offences Act decriminalised homosexuality in England and Wales. Prior to the introduction of the new legislation, the hero of Alamein, Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, urged the House of Lords not to sanction the Act. And he said, I quote, "Our task is to build a bulwark which will defy the evil influences seeking to undermine the very foundations of our national character. I know it is said that this is allowed in France and some other countries. We are not French. We are not from other nations. We are British, thank God." Now, while Montgomery could not slow the momentum of changes to the civil law, nor shake off the rumours that he himself desired other men, his concerns were shared by policymakers within the armed forces. Military chiefs and the Wolfenden Committee agreed that decriminalising homosexual acts in the forces would affect discipline and threaten the safety of low-ranking servicemen. As a result, they remained punishable by military law, even though they ceased to be illegal between consenting civilian men over the age of 21. Fast forward now to the middle of the 1990s, and human rights campaigners spearheaded by Stonewall, Outrage and Rank Outsiders were increasing their pressure on the government to overturn the ban. Now, within Parliament, debate raged. Particularly in 1995, we have an MP, a Labour MP, by the name of Harry Cohen. He was the MP for Leyton, and he argued for the inclusion of queer personnel in the armed forces by referring back to the Second World War. And he said, "This year is the 50th anniversary of the end of the last war. The minister, Roger Friedman, should remember that then the country was happy for many people of homosexual orientation to fight and to lay down their lives for it. Their orientation was not held against them by their country then, so why is the minister adopting such a backward attitude now?" Now, some of the most poignant arguments for inclusion came not from campaigners and not from politicians, but from heterosexual veterans of the Second World War that wrote into the national press. And their letters helped to inform the debate, revealing not only the existence of men and women who desired members of the same sex, but also the value of these people to an institution which, in the name of efficiency, pursued a policy of intolerance that was publicly on paper. As one veteran recalled, "In 1943, I had a divisional officer, a captain of Marines who was overtly gay. he was also a heavily decorated hero. He was the first of many gay servicemen and women I met during 4 years in the Navy and later the RAF. I did not see or hear of any trouble or loss of discipline. And you'll see a very similar letter by a chap called A. Vans, writing to the editor of The Independent. That's the second account there. So aside from these letters, and the general public appeared to support the lifting of the ban too. In May 1997, two television chat show phone-ins showed that 75% and 80% respectively of those who called in believed that the ban on gays and lesbians serving in the military should be lifted. 2 years later, there was an NOP poll, which was commissioned by Stonewall, that revealed that 7 out of 10 Britons believed that gays and lesbians should be allowed to serve. So opinion is most definitely on their side. This overwhelming positive response from sections of the media and more widely the general public exposed the MOD and its very archaic, unresponsive policies. And the MOD were pretty much left to protest alone and not particularly effectively. There was one very memorable occasion when a serving member of the armed forces who was sitting in the audience of Question Time tried to explain his objection to serving with an out colleague and eventually concluded, amidst much audience hilarity, that he was scared at the thought of sharing a shower, which kind of isolated in his kind of position, sat in that great big audience, surrounded by laughter, made him seem pretty sort of, it seemed a very silly answer, really. Out on the streets, especially in London, the activities of Peter Tatchell and outrage were also beginning to ramp up, were also beginning to have a significant effect on the visibility of the issue in the public domain. So on the 2nd of November 1997, Tatchell organised a Queer Remembrance Day, which was followed by similar days in 1998 and 1999. Tatchell's main mouthpiece is the chap that you have seen on the very first slide. That's Dudley Cave. Dudley Cave was gay, died only just recently. He was a prisoner of war, a member of the army, served honourably, and he was also a very staunch critic of the Ministry of Defence. For 20 years before his death, Cave campaigned against the Royal British Legion's refusal to acknowledge that queer men and women had served and died protecting their country. He also lambasted their unwillingness to accept the involvement of gay and lesbian organisations in Remembrance Day. So in 1997, Cave marched at the head of a Queer Remembrance Day parade, and he was followed by campaigners carrying pink flags. They laid triangles at the base of the cenotaph, which I think were very quickly removed, and they just basically staged a bit of a protest, as you can see. Of course, you can imagine that the British Legion denounced all of this as distasteful, and this really should come as no surprise that they responded so aggressively. In the early 1980s, a spokesperson for the Legion condemned moves to promote the acceptance of gays and lesbians as an attempt to, quote, weaken our society. And they also declared that such individuals had no right to complain about being ostracised by Legion members. So it's not a particularly accepting organisation. So anyway, none of this led to any change in policy. This is what they wanted, this is what they didn't really get. You may or may not know that the change in policy, the lifting of the ban on gays and lesbians serving in the armed forces, only came in 2000 when the Ministry of Defence was challenged in the European Court of Human Rights. I suspect that had it not gone that far, things wouldn't have changed, but they were about to be, there was a very big legal challenge, so they had to kind of cave in, really. So it was a begrudging acceptance of queer personnel, and it had very little to do with a sea change in attitudes towards gays and lesbians. And as I said, had the legal challenge not occurred at such a high level, I think it's very likely that the MOD would have continued to resist the intake of gays and lesbians. Now, the lifting of the ban is not the end of the story, not for me anyway. In 2004, I began working on my PhD which examines the intersection between same-sex desire and military authority in Britain between 1939 and 1945. It sort of tracks the entrance of gay and lesbian personnel to the medical boards, to their service, and also how they were disciplined. Now, my research demonstrated that there was more tolerance and acceptance of queer personnel than outright hostility. And what renders the Second World War in Britain so inherently fascinating is that it led to a temporary loosening of pre-war prejudices and taboos, which I think is linked to the fact that citizenship during the war rested less on sexual orientation and more on individual service and sacrifice. If you were a contributor to your group and to your unit, if you were discreet and you brought value to the particular unit or the battalion, you would be accepted, tolerated, and retained. Officially as well, the military authorities, when it comes to discipline, are very accepting of same-sex activity, because you can imagine in the midst of a total war, losing trained personnel is not the best way forward. There are all kinds of activities. They would send known queer men into the cities where they could avoid prosecution. There were lots of different techniques that officials had to try and avoid prosecution. So there is a tolerance there. Despite this evidence, this overwhelming evidence to suggest that the vast majority of people that served alongside gay and lesbian personnel, the vast majority of veterans, have positive memories, and that they responded positively to my research, I think it's worth sharing with you the negative responses that I also received. Because I think what these show is that the queer soldier continues to wreak quite a lot of havoc on the sanctity of the Second World War, because it is a very sacred war to us. We have particular conceptions about the Second World War in popular culture. So a lot of these veterans that wrote in to me to condemn my work are very sort of interesting to look at. I'll go into this into a bit more detail in a minute. But this is, I think, one of the most memorable attacks that I had, because it made the sun. And I show it to my students and use it as an example of you know, writing controversial history. But anyway, this happened because I sent a request to lots of veterans organisations to assist me, so to tell me stories of maybe people they served with, or if they happened to have members that might have been gay or were gay. When this particular appeal reached the head of the Monte Cassino Veterans Association, the head of that association, John Clark, decided that he would report my request to the Sun. So that's what happened. And he says, if you can't read that, "In our day, homosexuality was a crime, and I don't know of any gay men I saw service with. She wanted me to contact members of my association. After I spoke to one or two of them, they went berserk. Wouldn't the money be better spent elsewhere? They would be better off finding someone to do a write-up about the trauma of combat." So what Clark did is he constructed queerness as un-British. That is, as inconceivable in the British armed forces, yet he believed prevalent in the German army. A conclusion that he came to me in an early letter in which he claimed to have discovered dead German soldiers wearing makeup. The real root of Clark's argument, however, was not the foreign menace of same-sex desire, but the presumed illegality of queer soldiers, which in his mind meant that they could not possibly have been recruited into any of the services and certainly would not have been retained within them. In actual fact, there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that gay men and women were systematically tested and excluded at their medical boards, nor that every man and woman who admitted their desire for members of the same sex were expelled from the services. There are, in actual fact, stories of men and women who are forcibly retained in spite of their open declaration because they're too valuable to lose. Anyway, back to the Sun for 2 minutes. I think it was 3 days, probably says that on the, yeah, 3 days after the Sun was published on the left-hand side, we have David Sullivan diving in, who wrote for the Sunday Sport. The proclaimed voice of common sense, self-proclaimed I should say, called my research an exercise in political correctness. and Sullivan inaccurately stated that I was receiving taxpayers' money to ask the Second World War veterans about their experiences of gay and lesbian colleagues, which is a bit of a distortion of what I was trying to do. But they tend to roll out this taxpayer issue when they think that it's unjustified that someone's researching something other than, I don't know, something justified. So this divergence between the hidden narratives of my interviewees, the men that I interviewed as part of this study, and the non-existent narratives of veterans like Clark has been reiterated continuously by those who have opposed my research. One veteran believed that I was inventing false stories and framed his objections around the perception of the Second World War as a sacred and moral battle. In my sort of highlighting of the existence of queer personnel in the armed forces, the veteran believed that I was denigrating the sadness of the war, its dead, and the contribution of himself and his wife. And he recommended that I, quote, study what true history you can find and do not think of inventing false stories. There were virtually none for you to find because we treated such nonsense at best as a stupid joke or at worst as not worth wasting time on. Apart from the Sun article, I think the most offensive letter was written by, I think, probably a very elderly male correspondent, judging by the handwriting, which was kind of on slant. But he, in the absence of a convincing argument, reverted to personal insults, alleging that I was, quote, a corrupted tart and a, quote, PC milky liberal. He viewed homosexuality as a greater threat than global warming and asserted that, quote, we never ever thought of homosexuals in our day, or pufters, as we would have called them. Trying to unpick these responses is not an easy task. Some veterans made clear references to the perceived and obviously wildly stereotypical incompatibility of queer sexuality and military masculinity, the idea that a gay man could not possibly fight, they're too weak to fight. Others seem to be reacting against the perception of the active queer man as a predator and express their concern about the vulnerability of the heterosexual soldier in communal environments. Now, these narratives do display a certain homophobic zeal, but there is more at work than simply prejudice. The Second World War has been constructed, still is constructed, as a sacred moral battle, a people's war, where the delineation between good and bad was clear. We knew who we were fighting against. The enemy was easy to kind of identify, and it was good versus evil. Now, some veterans simply did not want the sacredness of their war to be dirtied by someone who wasn't there and who therefore wasn't qualified to comment. That was something that was rolled out quite a lot from veterans. You weren't there, therefore how can you talk about this? Now, John Clark, of Sun fame, felt particularly aggrieved that I was exposing one group out of a mass monolithic force as worthy of recognition. Before he took his complaint to the Sun, he wrote me a letter which, apart from talking about Germans wearing makeup, expressed his objection to my research. He expressed it in quite clear terms. He said that it was the forgotten veterans of his organisation, the Monte Cassino Veterans Organisation, they were the ones that needed to be acknowledged and commemorated. So his notepaper, for example, was festooned with the stamp, "The Forgotten Army." And along with his letter, he also sent me a poem that was called the D-Day Dodgers, a term that many veterans of the Italian campaign adopted in light of their belief that their contributions were eclipsed by the events of D-Day. So what this reveals, I think, is an unspoken hierarchy of recognition. John Clark did not believe that the people that I was studying deserved to be commemorated and remembered before his particular organisation. And this really isn't surprising, because as you know, it's a well turned out phrase now, the Second World War is moving unstoppably from memory to history. Those that feel forgotten wish to validate their experiences. However, as one group calls for recognition, others follow, demarcating their contribution against those of others. Now, the most telling example of this hierarchy is the granting of badges to both the Bevan Boys and the Land Army in 2007, gestures which follow closely behind the unveiling of Britain's only memorial to the women who contributed to the Second World War. So we have this sense of a layering process, really. In the case of queer soldiers, their contributions are worthless to veterans like Clark because of the presumed incompatible relationship between their sexuality and military masculinity. And it's this incompatibility that demarcates their contributions as inferior to those of their heterosexual counterpart. And this means, by extension, in the minds of men like Clark, that they should not be remembered. The mere suggestion that queer soldiers might have served in the armed forces is also regarded as a challenge to British military masculinity and the homosociability that underpinned and continues to underpin the services. So I would argue, and this is something I argue in my book, that it's the close proximity of homosociability, the bonds between men. It's that proximity between homosociability and homosexuality that really makes some surviving veterans uneasy about the idea that they might have served alongside queer comrades. So, to conclude, in spite of the activities of LGBT campaigners and the suggestion made audible by those in favour of the inclusion of queer personnel in the armed forces that there were lessons to be learned from the Second World War, queer men and women are still absent from the collective memory of the Second World War. Now, what I've been doing and what I'll continue to do is vie against this amnesia in collective memory on their behalf, which sounds a bit kind of pioneering and I don't know what else, but it's something that I'm quite hell-bent on doing, really. Because I think that these men and these women more than deserve a space in the national narrative of the Second World War. As I've said, though, the Second World War is a deeply precious war, and it's this status, this continued sanctity, which prevents the unproblematic integration of the queer story into our story, the story of a triumphant Britain. This in itself demonstrates just how deeply political and contested collective memory really is. And so what I want to suggest as a kind of parting shot is that these are the kinds of stories that we need to look at with our students, whether A-level, whether university, whatever level of student. We need to look at what is remembered, why it's remembered and how it's remembered. I think we need to be working with students to tell alternative stories, the stories that don't fit neatly into the textbooks, the stories that are slightly controversial or tell a different side of things. Because I think that it's only by illuminating these kinds of narratives that we'll come to teach richer, more textured lessons about the war, about the people that contributed to it, and about the much longer struggle for minority rights. Thank you.